This is Hindsight and a journey into the past to uncover the stories of the Roaring Girls.
With jacket blue and trousers white, just like a sailor, neat and tight, the sea was the heart's delight of the rambling female sailor. From stem to stern she'd boldly go, she'd braved all danger, feared no foe. Mary Read.
Anne Bonny.
One of the things that I found really intriguing about these stories was that the women do describe, you know, this kind of bloodlust. They want to go off and they want to fight in wars, or they want to go to sea for the same reasons that men do.
In the first half of the 18th century, when piracy was at its peak, the lives of two women came to the fore.
Bonny and Read.
These were the pirates, Anne Bonny and Mary Read. Dressed as men, Bonny and Read sailed the Caribbean as part of the notorious crew of the pirate Captain Rackham. There's little documentation about the origins of Anne Bonny and Mary Read, or about how they ended up on the same ship. But they are known to have one thing in common, something which would shape the trajectory of the rest of their lives.
What's really interesting, if you put Anne Bonny's story next to Mary Read's, next to Marianne Talbot's, who are all women who somehow got involved with piracy and were cross-dressing, their origins, they were all bastards. Daughters, basically. And it's somehow, as a result of their illegitimacy, it's almost in order to protect themselves in many cases, they take on the guise of a boy.
Julie Wilwright is author of Amazons and Military Maids, A History of Women and Cross-Dressing.
I mean, if you think about how Mary Read and Anne Bonny happened to be there, I mean, simply because in the late 17th, early 18th century, I mean, this is the kind of golden era, the kind of halcyon days of pirating, and there were one estimate is that there are 2,000 to 3,000 pirate ships in the Caribbean at that time. So in the same way that regular sailors end up on pirate ships, you know, if you have a significant number or even any number of women who are disguised as sailors, they're going to end up there too, for whatever reason. But what's particular about the pirate ships is that you have a kind of inversion of the regular rules anyway. I mean, everything that happens on a pirate ship is different. So, you know, they're kind of making up their own rules, and if the captain decides to bring his gal along, and everyone agrees with that, and the gal, I mean, but, you know, again, that happened on Royal Navy ships as well, but the difference here is that, you know, with someone like Anne Bonny, she's got her own cutlass and she's got her own pistol, and, you know, she's prepared to live that kind of life as well.
In waters scarlet with slaves' blood, brown with cloves, flecked in gold, I sailed bandanaed. Around me, corsair boys and buccaneers, and in me, a certainty of battle cries.
The freedom enjoyed by many of the pirates in the Caribbean would finally be wrestled from them by the imperial powers, who had the security of their trading routes at stake. And so it was that Anne Bonny and Mary Read found themselves on trial in Jamaica, to be judged by the full weight of the British Crown.
Mary Read and Anne Bonny were picked up with and tried with the rest of Captain Rackham's crew in 1720. And from the outset, there's no kind of distinction made in terms of the kind of charges that were brought against them. They both pleaded not guilty. But what's fascinating is what the witnesses who were actually taken aboard the pirate ship, or who had their goods taken from them, because there were two merchant ships that Captain Rackham's crew had held up. And then there was also a woman who was in a kind of longboat, had various provisions by the name of Dorothy Thompson. So you've got these various people who are actual eyewitnesses to the role that Mary Read and Anne Bonny played on the pirate ship at the time.
Both of these pirates wore men's jackets and long trousers and handkerchiefs tied about their heads. And each of them had a machete and pistol in their hands and cursed and swore at the men. They called for the men to murder me should I come against them. The reason by which I know and believe them to be women was by the largeness of their breasts.
One of the French sailors who was aboard Captain Rackham's ship actually describes an incident where the ship is being attacked and all the men have gone down into the hold. And Mary Read and Anne Bonny are standing at the top saying, come out and fight like men. And in fact, I think there's one point where Mary Read actually fires a pistol down into the hold to get them to come up aboard. So you get this impression that they were very aggressive and that they were very, you know, you could say that they were rather bloodthirsty. And I mean, it's difficult to know because often what happens in these stories is because the women are exceptional, it's almost as if people can't resist kind of piling it on a bit.
The bells rang out from the whitewashed towers of Santiago de la Vega on Jamaica's north shore. Their deep bass tone filled the narrow cobbled streets, the cool stucco homes, glanced off the red-tiled roofs of the government buildings, so like those of old Spain on which they were modelled. Pealing, pealing. Today the court sits in session. Today is the trial of pirates. Today will be tales of the sweet trade, of murders and crimes most notorious, villainy on the high seas. The ringing found its way into Mary Read's cell. A pretty sound, she thought. Pretty for a death knell.
I first heard the story of Anne and Mary in it's actually an extremely appropriate location. It was the quarterdeck of a replica of Sir Francis Drake's Golden Hind. It was the first traditional sailing ship that I worked on, something that I did for a living before I became a writer. And I was fascinated by the story. Of course, you can't read any history of pirates that doesn't mention Anne Bonny and Mary Read because they are so very unique and their story is so compelling.
Jim Nelson, who wrote the novel The Sweet Trade, under his pen name Elizabeth Garrett. Based on the lives of Anne Bonny and Mary Read, the story begins at their trial by the British in 1721. And there's a certain symmetry to this book, written by a man in the guise of a woman, about two women who disguise themselves as men.
Whenever I tell someone roughly about the story, about how Anne and Mary met, and how Anne fell in love with Mary, thinking she was a man, and how they sailed together dressed as men and fought as pirates, and how they were the only ones standing on the deck defending the ship from the boarders while the men were cowering below, and how they were both pregnant at their trials and they were sentenced to death. Whenever I tell anyone, they're just amazed to hear it and amazed that such a thing could have happened. And again, they were it not for the fact that they're witnesses to their lives, it would be very easy to dismiss the whole thing simply as sort of a crazy story. The amount of pirating they did, the amount of loot that they captured, the terror that they inflicted on the Caribbean, they were really pretty much small-time criminals. It's their story that's so incredible. It's really the story of their lives that has made them live on in history now after 300 years.
Mary stood up at last, paced the few steps forward and then back again. Her body still ached from countless bruises, some overlapping one another, purple and ugly. Her skin was hard and tight, where a dozen lacerations were just now healing. She paused, stretched, idly scratched herself, realized what she was doing and stopped, thinking, I have been too long in the company of men.
There really are only two important sources about their lives. The foremost of those is a book called The General History of the Robberies and Murders of the Most Notorious Pirates. And this is a book that was written in 1724 by a fellow named Captain Charles Johnson. Now, a lot of scholars now believe that Johnson was actually a pen name for Daniel Defoe. And there's a considerable debate either way on that point. Whoever wrote it, the author of the book, it was really sort of the Herodotus of the pirates. Virtually everything that we know about Anne and Mary in their early lives comes from this book. The story of how Mary was dressed as a boy from a very young age to to hide the fact that she was illegitimate, and how she served as a horse soldier in Flanders, how she served in a British man of war, how she married her tent mate when she was in the army and they opened an inn together. All of this comes from the General History of the Pirates, Defoe's book. Same is true of Anne Bonny. Everything that we know about her, her marriage to James Bonny, a penniless sailor, their running away to Nassau, her falling in love with Jack Rackham, all of this comes from Defoe's book. Unfortunately, there's no other source to corroborate what Defoe's written, so we really have to take Defoe's word on it. Probably the most important primary source that we have are the trial transcripts of the two women and Jack Rackham. And fortunately, for all historians of pirates, you have that wonderful public records office in Kew in London, which is a repository for all of this this material. And it wasn't too difficult to get a photocopy of the trial transcripts. And in the transcripts, you have the only actual eyewitness testimony about the women. And it's fascinating stuff.
They whispered, "'Tis a pirate's hole."
Both of these pirates wore men's jackets and long trousers and handkerchiefs tied about their heads.
She sails the seas for plunder.
He actually tends to get a little moralistic at times and talk about how how evil these people were. It was more shocking, to be sure, that they were women, and kind of lurid. I think this was kind of the closest that you were going to get to erotic true crime literature in the early 18th century, and I think that's one of the reasons that it was so very popular.
Annie, stir yourself, Mary called across the alleyway. Come on, Anne. They can't hang you laying down like that, you know.
Mary, dear, did I hear bells? Anne asked at last.
You did. They're a signal that a court of admiralty will sit today.
A court of admiralty? Whoever is to be tried?
Pirates, as I hear it. Notorious cutthroats and pickeroons.
Detestable people. I wish they would hang them all.
Mary smiled and Anne smiled back. They may yet, Annie, my dear.
Everyone was found guilty and they were sentenced to death. And it's very interesting because at first the sentence is passed and Mary Read and Anne Bonny say nothing in their defense and they add nothing once the sentence has been passed. But then there's a kind of pause and they both step forward to say that they're pregnant. The phrase is actually they're quick with child. They were pleading what was known then as pleading the belly. So they were the execution would be stayed until after they'd actually given birth to their respective children. And poor old Mary Read actually dies in prison of a fever. Well, no one really knows what happens to Anne Bonny, but there is one suggestion that she does make her way back to America to her family, and she's married off to a respectable gentleman and goes on to have another 8 children.
I'll trample myth's padlocks, though my feet are on brine. I'll sing of my sea skills in no fairground jig time. I'll tell of my voyage as mulled praise and warning. I'll show you my murders and of my heart's deforming.
A lot of these women were very young when they went off, and that's what enabled them to maintain their disguise. I mean, a lot of them would certainly have gone off as adolescents. But I think that on the pirate ships, I'm quite prepared to believe that, you know, the men may well have known, and because of that particular kind of pirate culture and pirate society, if you can call it that, there would have been a kind of tolerance because all sorts of other things were tolerated. I mean, as I said, it was, you know, they were constructing their own world and they were making up their own rules. But the other thing I wanted to say about the whole issue of whether the other sailors would have known is that I think that sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't. I mean, it's very hard in some of these stories, I mean, as they're written from the late 18th, early 19th century that, I mean, for example, you have Hannah Snell, who served several years aboard a British Navy ship, and at one point she's flogged, and, you know, her story repeats. The story as it's told at the time is that no one notices because she's so muscular that, and, you know, her breasts are very small and she kind of manages to hunch her shoulders. So there's some kind of story along those lines, and you think, well, hang on a minute, it doesn't seem terribly likely. But what we do know is, you know, absolute documented fact that there were dozens of women who did this.
August 3rd, 1721.
Off Guadeloupe Island, where the Atlantic meets the Caribbean.
Mary turned back to the sea and searched the fog again. There, a shadow was forming off the starboard bow, and in a few heartbeats, the Wraith became a twin-masted brigantine, flying the King Louis flag of France. Mary pointed out where the ship lay, and the men stood poised, watching her. At her signal, the Fury crept closer toward its prey. Soon, very soon, as they neared their target, with cannons at the ready, Captain Mary leapt atop the rail of her ship, shouting, "For the Fury! For gold! For glory!" As she went into battle, a childhood memory filtered across Mary's thoughts. Thou shalt not kill.
With the publication of Captain Johnson's History of the Pirates, which follows very quickly after the trial, it's very interesting to see the way in which even then the women are being both romanticized but exaggerated and kind of made into these caricatures. I think that what happens is that when you find women who are in the company of men, they're often seen to be either mascots and therefore kind of somehow removed from the action, or they're at the other extreme. They're a kind of almost caricature of masculinity.
What a woman she was! Rather slender and short. Her hair jet black. Her face and dark eyes were intelligent. Not too Chinese, although purely Mongolian, of course, and rather hard. Madame Zheng Yisao.
She was from South China, from the province of Guangdong. She was probably a prostitute in the Canton region, and this meant that she plied her trade on a boat, because most of the brothels were floating boats in that time and that place.
Diane Murray, talking about Madame Zheng Yisao, who commanded a fleet of over 900 pirate ships on the South China Sea in the early 19th century. Piracy had been intertwined into the lives of fishing communities in this part of the world for centuries. But it took continued political instability, largely from rebel emperors in modern-day Vietnam, to turn the scattered pirate ships into a major privateering fleet. In 1802, the Chinese pirates formed themselves into a confederacy and were powerful enough to pose a major threat to both their own ruling emperors and also to the European powers who traded in the Far East. Historian Diane Murray has studied the life of one of the pirate rulers in 19th century Asia, Madame Zheng Yisao.
She came to prominence first through marriage. She married Zheng Yi. Sao simply means wife, so this term Zheng Yisao simply means Mrs. Zheng or wife of Zheng Yi. And Zheng Yi was one of seven or eight pirate chiefs who emerged as the big shots, the big guys. I think it was he who probably along with her, because I think they were teamed up by this time, who created this confederation, who caused the pirates to unite and to have a kind of systematic way of registering vessels, of figuring out how to share booty, of operation at sea. And when he died in 1807, it wasn't foreordained that she would take over command of the fleets, but it happened that way. And I think it happened that way because she actually was the most effective and the most compelling leader. She seemed to work by securing her personal allegiance to the fleet leaders who were under her, and seemed to beat out two of Zheng Yi's shirt-tail relatives in terms of taking over this confederation.
Merely to write her biography would be to produce a tale of adventure such as few people dream of. Mr. Aleko E. Lilius. I sailed with Chinese pirates, 1930.
I think she was very astute. I think she had a good sense of order, and I think that Zheng Yisao is very unusual in that she was a woman who had a public appearance. One can question how far the dictates of Confucian society permeated pirate ranks. There were a number of people at that time who lived their lives solely on board vessels. Now, I can't tell if her background is that or not, but these women would not have bound their feet. And my guess is she probably didn't have bound feet, which would have meant that she could have moved around a lot more.
She was exquisitely dressed in a white satin robe, fastened with green jade buttons and green silk slippers. She was probably not yet 40. Every move she made and every word she spoke told plainly that she expected to be obeyed. And as I had occasion to learn later, she was obeyed.
The red flag feat was the most prominent of the, at that time there were seven. She was the commander of that fleet by virtue of the fact that that was the one that her husband had commanded. In the Red Flag fleet, there were probably 15 to 20,000 men and maybe 300 to 400 junks. She chose not to rule or govern that fleet directly, but worked through the agency of another man by the name of Zhang Bao. And Zhang Bao was the son of a fisherman who, along with his father, was captured by the pirates one day at sea. He was captured actually by Zheng Yisao's husband, Zheng Yi. He found favor in Zheng Yi's eyes and was given command of vessels while Zheng Yi was very much alive. And then upon his death, he became the husband and the lover of Zheng Yisao. And in terms of how she commanded the overall confederation, she had very strict laws that were obeyed. If one, you know, got booty, one couldn't pocket it and run. There were rules about how much had to be shared with the common treasury. There were provisions for fleets that didn't do as well. She seemed to have codes of conduct vis-a-vis other members of the pirates and other women captives. It's hard to know exactly how strictly those codes were enforced, but there are a couple of Westerners who were held captive on these vessels, and they report that occasionally pirates were flogged or punished when they violated the codes. So I think if we can use the expression, she ran a pretty tight ship.
What a character she must be. What a wealth of material for a novelist or journalist. Mr. Aleko E. Lilius. I sailed with Chinese pirates.
What led to the undermining and what I call the successful surrender were a variety of things. I think that by 1809, 1810, they had been so successful that shipping was down along the coast. And I think that if you look at the numbers of European ships, those vessels were down. I think the coast was beginning to be picked clean. That was one element. Number two, in that period, the central government sent down to be governor general of the provinces of Guangxi and Guangdong, a very savvy official who really was trying to take fighting the pirates very, very seriously. Now, it took a long time for them to come to a decision that it was time to surrender. It was initially undertaken by the guys, and Zhang Bao and figures in the governor's yamen in Guangdong were all supposed to be meeting and to be hashing out the terms of the surrender, and the boats all gathered on a certain day. And we don't know exactly what happened, but somebody got cold feet, fired a shot. It may have been a shot, a cannon shot of welcome. But in turn, the government forces got scared, and all the ships withdrew, and the negotiations completely fell through. So a couple of months later, the story has it that Mrs. Zheng and the women picked up the pieces and went trooping into the governor's yamen in Canton. That's a little hard to believe, but it may have been the case. And anyway, she then is the one who is given credit for having finally arranged the terms that brought a successful conclusion to the fleet and allowed the surrender to take place successfully and without too much of an incident.
She was exquisitely dressed in a white satin, jet black. Merely to write her biography would be to produce a tale of adventure. Her earrings, dark eyes, of the same precious apple. Not too Chinese, although purely Mongolian, of course, and rather hard.
I think that the fact that she was a woman pirate in a region of the world that was already exotic in most Western eyes, made her a subject of interest. And when the historical record didn't provide information, historical imagination took over. And so if you read some of these pieces, you can get some fairly graphic and fantastic descriptions with her, everything from a sensuous beauty to an oily, haggard, ugly woman. So to my mind, none of them are authentic.
Who hath desired the sea, the immense and contemptuous surges, the shudder, the stumble, the swerve as the star-stabbing bowsprit emerges?
You know, I think that's wonderful that we're able, through these stories, to look at history in a new and different way. And I think it gives us real insight into how women must have thought about themselves and their possibilities and how they could overcome them.
Casting off from my snake chamber, I sail with you in sable. Maidens all, our shields shine and we tack and win, then lose to anxious princes. And now, my sovereignty, packed in ice, bleeds in the bay. But my rudder, safely cured in kelp, awaits my daughter's bare, brave hand. This has been the history of the Roaring Girls, women pirates across the ages. Readings were by Tamara Kennedy, with technical production from Judy Rapley. I'm Michelle Rayner.